We have a great program for you today. I'm going to introduce Coral Andrews in a moment. She'll tell you a little about herself. And the program today is about the Hawaii Healthcare Association. What does the Hawaii Healthcare Association do for elders? And I guess with that, let me turn it over to Coral, who would rather give her presentation right from the middle over there. So we'll come back to the podium later for questions. Thanks very much, Coral.
Okay, thank you, Larry. A little bit about our organization and myself. Not that I don't necessarily have great comfort in talking about myself, but being that Larry mandated that that be part of my introduction, I'm happy to oblige. First of all, the organization that I'm with is called the Healthcare Association of Hawaii. We're a trade association comprised of members, and our members are hospitals, we have long-term care providers, assisted living and nursing facilities, and also home care and hospice providers. So those that provide home health, those that provide home care, and I'll share with you all of this terminology as we go through today's program, hospices, durable medical providers, and infusion companies that go out into the community if people need intravenous medications. The association has been around for a long time, since the 1940s, and our primary responsibility is advocacy for issues that impact those constituents whom we serve. And so we spend a lot of time down at the legislature, so many of the faces here today are familiar to me. And we have frequented with our congressional delegation. We are also affiliated with three national organizations, the American Hospital Association, the American Healthcare Association, and the National Association of Home Care and Hospice. So if you can, as you can imagine, while there are things churning here on the state level, similarly, there's a lot of activity in Washington that we're receiving regular updates from our national organizations, and we have responsibilities to them as well. So it's never dull. There's a lot happening in healthcare right now, so it's especially busy. A little bit about myself. I've been with the Healthcare Association for 5 years, but I've been in healthcare for going on my 27th year. I'm a registered nurse by background, have a master's in business administration, and I've had a dual career track, both in the civilian sector and in the military. I retired August the 1st as a captain in the U.S. Navy Reserves, and spent about 5 years up at U.S. Pacific Command in international relations and diplomacy prior to coming here. So I think that has some relevance because it helps me out in those moments I need to remain cool when I'm over at the legislature. So let me give you kind of a 20,000-foot view of some of the things we're involved in at the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, but then more specifically, what I'm going to do is cover a piece of legislation that passed in the 2009 special session. George Green is our president and CEO, and he is on the mainland today and was unable to join you. So the topical area that we're going to focus on is going to digress a little bit from what was introduced. But as the association, we have ongoing meetings during the year with representatives from the state or stakeholder groups on issues that may be regulatory in nature. So we have a frequent interaction with Departments of Health and Department of Human Services. We have a Director of Emergency Services, Toby Claremont, who administers the requirements in a HRSA Hospital Preparedness Grant. So we have ongoing training and interaction with hospitals, nursing facilities, home health providers in how prepared for an emergency. So as we're all sitting here watching the news today, looking at the hurricane preparedness that's taking place in the Gulf, on the Gulf Coast, know that here in Hawaii, through the Healthcare Association of Hawaii with our Department of Health partners, we're always working to make sure that our healthcare providers in the state are ready for emergencies. So regulatory issues we've covered. As I look around the room, I'm involved in Kupuna Caucus. I'm involved in the Joint Legislative Committee on Aging in Place, which are forums over at the legislature that look at issues on aging. And that ranges from home care licensure to helping look at ways to assist seniors in preparing to age in place in their homes. So a number of issues. I'm also on the Home for Life Task Force. I look across at Tony Lenzer that Senator Leslie Hara is going to be kicking off, which was also a piece of legislation that passed a year ago. So a number of issues. Of course, we have our eyes on the gubernatorial election this year. We're all interested in anticipating what changes may occur in our state's government as we proceed to transition to a new administration. We've been heavily involved in keeping up with the provisions in the federal health reform legislation. A little bit about that. Not all of the components of federal health reform will be implemented in 2010. If you've heard much about it, the content of it will be phased in between 2010 and 2014. The key components of federal health reform seek to improve access to care and to expand coverage. So in this year, you'll be seeing small business tax credits. You see the children being able to remain on their parents' health coverage up to age 26. And as we phase out to 2014, some of the themes that you'll see emerging in finality will be the health information technology requirements that are being imposed on providers and hospitals. That's a whole other in-service federal health reform. We're happy to come back and provide the 101 on that for all of you. But let me take some time to walk you through the story about the home care licensure bill that passed in the 2009 special session. And what I anticipated is we'll just sort of have a conversation around this today. So you have a handout in front of you. It's not the entire bill, but here's the journey of this bill to passage. When I joined the Healthcare Association of Hawaii in 2005, there had already been a lot of work done looking at Chapter 97, which is the administrative rules section of Department of Health that speaks to home health. Now, some differences in nomenclature. Home health is typically used as sort of a Medicare term that focuses on services that individuals receive in their homes, but it's skilled care. So skilled care means that it's usually physician directed. You have to have a physician that says you need this physical therapy and you need it 3 times a day, or you need a nurse coming in your home. And so they sign off on a prescription. Home care or private duty is consumer-directed care. So the consumer is making the decisions about care that they need that may be custodial in nature, but still very helpful in allowing the consumer to remain in his or her home or his or her home-like environment. So it could be also services that you receive in assisted living or in a care home. So it's a home or home-like setting. There were discussions that occurred between our members and the Department of Health as they walked through the existing regulations of Chapter 97 and trying to get themselves to a place where they could actually move forward with home care licensure. When I came on board, what we began to do is build upon the previous work and formalize our efforts and take it on over to the legislature. And I know in speaking with many of you, you have past lives where you've been very involved in advocacy. So what that tells me is at some point I'm going to be coming to these meetings as I begin to mature as well and continue my advocacy efforts here in Hawaii. But the first thing we had to do is start to educate legislators about why we needed this bill. Well, let me tell you what I've heard about why we need this bill. There are a couple of forces that are drawing us in the direction to really stay focused on consumer safety in the community. We have the consumer's expressed desire to be able to remain at home for as long as possible. We also have both the federal and the state government looking at ways that we can deliver services in a more costly way to consumers in their home. And we have the highest rate of elderly growth of any state in the nation here in Hawaii. So you take all of those things and they're pointing in the direction. Anytime money flows someplace, you've got to keep your eye on it, because there's going to be growth, but there's also going to be naughtiness. And so what we recognize is we needed to get ahead of the curve and get out there and put just some minimal protections in place for consumers. If they wanted to be able to have home care services that they purchased, that they had some discretionary way of determining company ABC, well, what do we know about them? Well, they advertise quality care. Well, what's the benchmark for that? So we went around, talked to the legislators, helping them to understand what is licensed currently. So home health agencies are required to be licensed by the Department of Health. Home care agencies only require a general excise license. So I could go down tomorrow and I could create a company, call myself something, and I could have access to your home. I could have access to someone's home who has no means of even taking defensive measures against themselves. Yet we license truck drivers. We license 17-year-olds to drive vehicles. Think about all the other ways don't we have to have a license to cut hair? I think so. But we don't license people, or we don't license agencies that have access to our most vulnerable populations. So we felt like if we couldn't get them through the logic mode, we could do it through the emotional appeal. And that was our strategy in going around and speaking with the legislators. I'm sort of joking. But the idea here is, when you're doing advocacy work, it's a lot easier to advocate when it's something that really makes sense and is very sellable. Well, it took a couple of years of this bill going through the legislature before we began to gain much traction on it. So who would oppose something that's motherhood and apple pie? Well, let me tell you some of the things that got us hung up. One was just trying to figure out why we needed it. Did we have data to substantiate why we needed it? Well, I went through the yellow pages and I looked for how many home care agencies do we have in the state. I called over to the GET office and asked them, could they do a search and tell me how many licensed home care agencies do we have in the state? Well, our systems don't allow for that kind of a search. They can search through a category that just says health, but there was no other discretionary searchable means of determining how many home care agencies were in place. Because we have national affiliate organizations, I reached across state exec colleagues through the National Association of Home Care and Hospice and said, can you tell me what you're doing in your state? So let's trend it and look at, are we an anomaly here because we're asking for this, or are we just keeping pace with the norm? So we were able to determine, and I believe Rob Perez recently ran an article about this, showing that the data does indicate that the majority of states now are moving in this direction. The challenge is that we haven't come to an agreed upon nomenclature. When you search across other states, some of them have combined their home health and their home care licensing under one administrative rules section. But as we chipped away at it, and I can update you on where we're at with the administrative rules writing process, we've begun to sort of define for ourselves where we see those distinctions are. So we did this research. We went in, allow the bill to run its course, going through the subject matter specific hearings and then through finance, because there were implications to the agency that would be the licensing entity. They would have to hire additional staff in order to have someone available to complete the licensing function. And a couple of issues arose. One, who should be the licensing entity? Should it be Department of Health, or should it be Department of Human Services? Well, home health agencies, those that require the physician's prescription to determine a service, and Chapter 97 is where those regulations are held, are licensed by the Department of Health. Department of Human Services, though, because they provide home and community-based services, felt that this was a home and community-based role. So as you can imagine, we began our debate over where should the licensing function be housed. Internally within the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, because we service members, we do everything by survey or by vote. And we asked our members, what do you think? And unanimously, everyone wanted DOH to be the licensing entity. And the reason they felt that way were a couple of reasons. One, they felt that it was logical. They said, if you have an agency, so now we're going to some of the things that compelled us to take action on this. If you have an agency that's providing a service in the community, but maybe encroaching in the types of services that they're providing into a home health arena, so there may be goodwill behind what they want to provide, but really what they're doing is they're taking on, an individual may be inadvertently taking on a function that should be performed by a professionally licensed individual, that we felt that the home health surveyors, the licensing surveyors for home health, would already have some sense of when a service is a home health service as opposed to when a service is a home care service. So we thought that they would be the best entity for going out and taking on home care agency surveys because they could be watching for both. Am I making sense? So example, if a home care agency, so home care agencies are not licensed, has a person who goes into the home and is providing a function that should be provided by a registered nurse under the supervision of a physician, then that should be a function that falls under an agency that's licensed as a home health agency. So the long and short of it is, we felt very strongly that we wanted Department of Health to do it. Department of Human Services opposed us through the duration of the bill hearings because they wanted to be the ones to license. Well, when you're dealing with taking on new regulatory requirements, you always have to keep in mind what is the cost, potential cost impact that could eventually hit the consumer. So you balance being prudent with balancing with what the consumer can still afford. And that's one of the fears that emerged that we heard about was, well, what is this going to mean when it comes to a consumer wanting to purchase a service from a home care agency? Is the regulation going to add on additional cost? And we said, well, we checked with other states, and there may be some incremental cost. But when you look at only having minimum requirements, criminal background checks, those aren't currently required. Communicable disease checks. Well, you have to have that if you work in a school. And some minimal training. If the person's transferring a senior from one place, let's say from a commode to an ambulatory position, shouldn't they at least have some idea of how to do that? Okay, well, that's what we thought too. Again, very sellable. And our concern was that we shouldn't focus our action on just trying to do something to keep it affordable. We felt that that was negligent on our part. If we were hearing about challenges occurring out in the community and we just said we were going to do nothing about it. So we worked with Commerce and Consumer Affairs committees and the chairs, again, to continue to educate, to provide a rationale, a basis of our argument, and fortunately, we were able, through the legislature's support, to get this bill passed in 2009. Well, it wasn't over. The bill got vetoed. And the reason the bill got vetoed, as I understand, was a couple of things. You'll notice, and we'll walk through the bill, but on page 3, which is your top sheet, it says in there, a service provider agency under contract for services with the City and County of Honolulu Elderly Affairs Division shall be exempt from the licensing requirement of this section. The City and County of Honolulu, as do other agencies, provide services through a combination of the use of volunteers as well as through utilizing nonprofits who provide these services. And they were very concerned that they were not going to be able to keep their programs running if there was any additional costs that they were going to incur. They also felt that they had some provisions and measures in place where they screened the individuals that were going out into the home. So we met with City and County and continued to have an ongoing working relationship with them around this issue. They support licensing, but they just felt that their program was going to be at risk with the implementation of this, and this was through feedback they were receiving from their contracted service agencies. Again, we met. Anytime you're going through the process of trying to advocate for a bill, as many of you know, you have to really put forth the effort to garner a consensus. Work, try to understand what are their issues. Is there a way for us to work through those issues? And we proceeded, we acknowledged, and they proceeded and acknowledged, and this was included in the bill. That was one thing I believe that the administration had concerns about. The other thing is that there was still objection to Department of Health being the entity that was the licensing entity. So the bill was vetoed, and the legislature overrode the veto, which allowed for the passage of Act 21. That took place in the 2009 special session, and we had already had conversations with Department of Health that given the current state of the economy, we would not, in the 2010 session, proceed to seek an appropriation for funding an FTE in the licensing branch. We just knew that the timing was terrible. And so we decided instead to spend our time convening a group that could work on the administrative rules, and our goal is by the 2011 session to have the rules finished and to go in for an appropriation for the FTEs within the Department of Health to staff this. And I have seen some documents that DOH is working on that demonstrate that our handshake agreement in that direction is proceeding on course. Oh, excuse me, full-time equivalents. So the hired staff that could administer the program. Thank you. Okay, let me just pause for a minute and ask if there are any questions before we walk through the bill. Tony.
Yeah. When you referred to we, I'm assuming that you're talking about people who are in the industry, who are involved in writing these administrative rules. It's a little bit difficult to quite imagine how that works in terms of protecting the consumers if the people who are writing the rules are the people who are going to be ultimately licensed under those rules. So I'm wondering if there is some conflict of interest in terms of who is writing the rules and how this is going to impact ultimately on consumers who are supposed to be protected by the rules.
I should have expected a difficult question from Tony. No, I'm just kidding. I think that's a very good question. So what's the process that we're using? Well, Senator Chen Oaklin, who's the Senate chair of the Human Services Committee, has worked as a convener, legislator, representative convener for this group. And what we did is we went out and asked who would be interested in participating. So some forums where we've advertised that have been at the Joint Legislative Committee on Aging in Place. We've gone out to our members asking them. City and County has representation on it. Several other home care agencies, but that's a good question. And I guess One of the processes that would allow for that to be fleshed out more clearly would be as the administrative rules work their way through public hearings. But I think you raise a good question. I guess I would just say that in the course of the discussions and in being ethical, I'm speaking for myself, having worked with an ethics attorney prior to coming over here, that I would say individually, I'm try to be very mindful of those things. Because I don't really see a win in it if there was some if we didn't try to do it judiciously. And I think we've stayed on message from the time that we vetted the bill to the legislature. We said our goal is to aim for minimum criteria. And those minimum criteria are actually very black and white. Criminal background check, yes, no. Communicable disease check, yes, no. Minimum training criteria. So the place where we're spending actually the majority of our time is trying to get into the definitions that show up on page 4, which are key core elements that are required in the course of writing the rules. And those are, what are the definitions of personal care? What are the definitions of respite? And what are the things that fall under homemaker assistance? But I think, Tony, to your question, and in trying to be as inclusive as we can be, anyone that is interested in participating in those meetings as a consumer or as an agency, we welcome any participation. And so after this meeting, I'm happy to provide you with my contact information. We're not too late in the process. You're welcome to join in, and I would hope that given Senator Chun Oakland's involvement, that that also provides some additional assurances that our goal is to be transparent and really to do this right. But I do appreciate your question, and you know, I think that we all have opportunities to learn in the course of this administrative rules process. Any other questions?
What has taken so long? We've had people needing home care for years and people going on. I see them advertised on the radio and TV all the time. I mean, I've lived here since 1948, and there have been people out there needing home care. Usually it was Catholic Charities that was out there more or less helping in the home needs. But this is, what, did something happen that called for this to start up? That's my question. But thank you.
I can share with you my understanding as I became involved in the process. I know there was a very active effort to directly to have direct discussions with Department of Health and to begin writing a chapter, a regulatory chapter on home care. And there were, I guess, differences of opinion in what should be included or what shouldn't be included. Once the bill was written and we began the process, the challenges were those that I mentioned. One, a concern that by making it a by mandating licensure, that it was going to exclude some groups who wanted to participate in providing those services at a time when there is a demand for those services. But I can certainly appreciate your question, because as I mentioned, to me it seems like motherhood and apple pie. And as a clinician, I just see the potential there for risk. And the consumer also hasn't been offered the opportunity to be provided information to educate them about what kinds of questions should they be asking when they go to purchase the service. So even within the admin rules drafting, the providers have collectively said, you can create licensure, you can write regulation, but the enforcement of that is only part of it. The other part of that is the consumer has to be made more akamai about what should they be looking for. What should they expect when they go to purchase a service? How do you know when something's wrong? And if you see something that's wrong, who do you tell? So we still have more infrastructure that needs to be created in order to make this a very circular system in delivering these home care services. But I agree with you. I think that the process took a long time, but in legislative terms, I understand we did pretty darn well.
There are different rules between the caregivers for personal care in the home and also for the caregivers in the residential homes, too. And I don't know at this point if they're going to look amount of criteria that both have to meet, or if it's going to be different. Because when they have several people in one home, they of course have people living with them, they have a certain number of them that they need. I used to work for nursing homes without walls, and I know that I had to go out and check on cases that have been brought to my attention by the case managers for possible abuse. And we found, that some of the caregivers lived upstairs, the clients were downstairs, the clients were bedbound. They had no way of communicating with those upstairs. So they could not be caregivers anymore under that kind of situation. And so they were pulled out and the patient put somewhere else. So there needs to be some things that are going to need to be the same in both because of the caregiver. And it's also going to need to be
okay, thank you. A couple of comments. That the recommendation in her comments were that as you design a system of care, whether it's a home care agency or care that's provided in a home-like setting, which is what we've developed here in Hawaii with care homes and foster family homes and what had been residential or RAC homes, that as you develop systems that provide protections in the services that are given to the consumer, there needs to be some consistency. Let me just comment a little bit on where we're at and how are we going to get there. The home care agency process will address those agencies that have individuals employed that are going out and providing services in some of the home community-based settings, but in other places as well. There are separate regulations that govern the services delivered in a care home, that's Chapter 100, and they are licensed by the Department of Health. Foster family homes are licensed by the Department of Human Services. And you are correct that there needs to be some consistency. Several years ago, the legislative auditor did a study trying to determine whether or not we needed to collapse foster family homes and care homes under one licensing entity. The recommendation in that report was to keep them separate, but I can tell you that in the community groups that I participate in, there's a loud noise swell brewing about that report needing to be redone or either just operating off of a new recommendation. Without getting into the weeds of those particular areas, I would encourage you, if you have specific questions, that we allow those providers the opportunity to speak for themselves. But as a clinician, let me just share with you some of the things that I've observed. When you have a model of care, so model meaning sort of like your schematic of how care is supposed to be delivered, there are certain things that are tried and true. We've tried them out in hospitals. We've tried them out now in nursing facilities. So as you scale through the healthcare delivery system, there are certain components that you know if you do this plus this, it's going to equal quality. If you have these people with this training, you reduce your risk or chance of injury. I think some of the things that the state really needs to take a look at is if you have a consumer who's a skilled level of care consumer and you're putting them in an expanded arch, which is licensed by Department of Health under certain regulations, and you take a skilled consumer and you put them in a foster family home, which is licensed and regulated by DHS, but the core components of the medical needs of those individuals are not approached similarly, then you have unequal measures. Yet, policies, both from the federal and the state government, are driving care in a direction to push towards the lowest level of care, i.e., the least expensive. The pitfall that we run the risk of falling into is that we don't keep our eye on the most important thing. The most important thing is that you have a care that allows for the greatest protection for the consumer. You cannot forget about cost, but you cannot let cost be what drives your decisions. And I would say to the next administration coming in, and the Healthcare Association of Hawaii has had some discussions about this, we've got to change the way we look at Medicaid. Currently, policies around Medicaid are looked at as it being a cost. Medicaid is a critical partner in the overall reimbursement scheme across this state. You have commercial payers, you have Medicare, you have Medicaid. Medicare typically, and I'm sort of drifting here for a minute, but I'm going to come back to the center. Medicare typically serves as an entity that helps to shore up what Medicaid doesn't fully cover. So in other words, if Medicaid paid 50 cents for something that really required a dollar, providers help utilize Medicare as an offset to what Medicaid underfunds. And then you have commercial payers, which are private health insurance. So as a business, they have a pie that makes up their full revenue stream. Medicaid has continued to, we've had reduced availability of funds in the state. We're not funded to cover the full cost of services that are needed for Medicaid consumers. Medicare, we're seeing additional cuts now with federal health reform, and we just keep taking little bites out of the cookie. So let me circle back around to kind of some of these comments. We have to devise policy that allows for the appropriate components to be included and funded so that those appropriate components can be part of what we deliver in a service or what we use to shape a model. We can't set a price and say, I'm going to pay you for a Ford, but I want you to deliver a Cadillac. The consumer is starting to get the short end of that stick, and I think we need to see some grassroots activity at the consumer level where they're saying, if I'm going to receive a service, there's some minimum components that I want involved in that, and challenging the next administration to begin to look at what should Medicaid look like so we can provide the services that the demand is requiring? Not let me design the services and keep cutting the costs, but it still expect you, provider healthcare delivery system, to do it. You're going to see companies going out of business. So did I answer your questions and comments?
How much money were they asking to implement this if they got it? And why I ask that is because I'm an advocate for grandparents raising grandchildren. And we had a bill out to not evict the senior from the housing, to give them just 3 months maximum so that they can get help rather than right away be evicted. And all of a sudden, housing throws in, well, we need $4 million and we could have a section for the build a park and the architect. And the way that it's written, it really, like other things, can be used in their budget. How much of this is just to pump up their budget?
rather than leaving things how they are, because that's where they should be.
The total funding impact to the state's budget was just for the full-time equivalent and some neighbor island travel if the individual needed to travel to the neighbor islands to license agencies, and my recollection was it was between $150,000 and $175,000 per year. And at some point, there was some discussion about a special fund that would allow for licensing fees to be utilized to help cover some of those offsets, because Department of Health gets some federal subsidy because they're the Medicare entity for the state, so it's basically the state-funded dollars that we're talking about. So between about $150,000 and $175,000 was the total budgetary impact. The rest of it, there shouldn't be any additional cost to the state. Okay, well, as we conclude today's discussion, I'll just share with you that on page 4 of the bill, those top three areas, the Administrative Rules Task Force has been meeting over a period of about 7 months. We've been focusing our attention the last few meetings on the definition of personal care. So what we've done is a sweep of existing statute in Department of Human Services and in administrative rules so that we make sure that in the course of writing these, we are using like terminology. And there is some housekeeping within the statutes that we will likely need to do as we go forward with the administrative rules, because there are some differences in how this terminology is used, whether you are talking about nursing home without walls or something else. And I think the intent is that we want to make sure that whatever definitions we're using, the definitions delineate what is a consumer-directed service and what are those services that may be provided under that definition that should take someone to a licensing requirement, say, under home health. So we have, I think, one more meeting and we'll nail down the personal care. Again, we've gone across other states looking at how they define personal care. So we've had more discussions about minutiae and things than you can imagine, but we're just trying to do what we can to get it right. And the same thing with respite, looking for definitions. There are statutory definitions of respite care. The one thing that will be left on the table, though, that we're going to have to go back and clean up at some point, in Chapter 97, which is the home health regulations, currently they utilize a definition that says skilled nursing and rehab services. If you have a company that provides one or the other, because it isn't or, they are not required to be licensed. Can you believe that? So we have some things we need to do to go back and sort of figure out where the nursing services component fits in there, because there are some nursing services, even under home care, that will be provided, but they're not physician-directed. So there's some oversight component that still needs to be part of this process. If you're sending an aide into a home and they identify something that would, let's say they see the skin beginning to break down on a consumer, that requires an assessment, and that assessment is usually done by a licensed person. So we're trying to sort of navigate our way through how do we take the area where those concentric circles meet and sort it into two separate buckets. Is it home health or is it home care? And we do look forward to working with other stakeholders to find a means of helping to get the education out to consumers so that they know what kinds of questions to ask as they prepare to purchase services from home care agencies. So that's all I have. I appreciate you all for inviting. Oh, excuse me, Laura.
When you say physician directed, could you tell us exactly what that is and how does that relate to consumers' choice?
something else that you said should be, that you consider.
Okay, physician directed means, let me give you an example, my mother-in-law, although I'm not sure if she'll appreciate it, but okay, we'll just say, as with all families, you've had situations where you may have had a family member who had a fall and had a fracture. And as a result of the fracture, in order for them to get back on their feet, there's a rehabilitative component. And it may mean that that rehabilitation transitions from a hospital to a short stay in a nursing facility and then onto the home. But there may be a period of continued rehabilitation before the person becomes stable. So an example of a physician-directed home health service is when you have someone who leaves a nursing facility but still needs a little more time to get strong to be able to transfer themselves from the bed to the chair. Or they have stairs in their home and they need to learn to do the stairs in their home more than what they were able to receive, say, in a four-week short-stay nursing facility. The physician will write a prescription, and the consumer is then given the option of choosing a home health agency to come and provide those physical therapy services in the home. That's just the physician-directed component just means that the agency should not be providing the service until they have that prescription from the physician, because the physician then looks at the reports that the agency prepares after the treatment to know how many more visits does the consumer need. For a home care agency, that business transaction is initiated by the consumer. The consumer can see something in a newspaper, they can look in a Yellow Pages. A family may decide to start looking for those services if they notice that their loved one is needing some additional assistance at home while they're away at work. And so the consumer initiates that business transaction. The administrative rules process, we have not gotten involved in any way, nor would it be appropriate for us to direct who falls within each of those categories. Am I understanding your question? So the consumer is the one still that has the choice about who they go to purchase those services. It's just a distinction between what are they authorized or licensed to provide, those that are licensed as home health and those as home care.
Yeah, I'm wondering, given the fact that consumers may need more than one service, under home care, are there provisions in the prospective rules for care management or case management?
Those fall under a separate set of rules. The case managers actually fall under a separate set of rules, at least for Department of Human Services. They are not required to be licensed by Department of Health, to my knowledge. So these do not include care coordination.
So if they needed that, what would that do?
So if an individual wanted a service that included the coordination of their care, at this time, my understanding would be that they would purchase those services through a case management agency. If the services are being provided under a waiver program, the waiver program may include some of those components. But if Larry, for example, had a family member that needed services, the consumers are having to piece those things together themselves. But your recommendation is that there be some acknowledgement of that care coordination?
So if you have a conflict maybe situation where people need more than one service and they have to go to the source to get help.
In the agencies that we've, I'm sorry, Roseanne, in the agencies that we're working with, let's say ones that are accredited, so there are some agencies that have elected to be accredited as a way of validating the quality of the services or some standard that they meet. And they pay for that on their own at several thousand dollars. But so in the agencies that we work with within the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, there's no provision for licensure yet in the state, but by bylaws, our members, if they are accredited or if they have a Medicare certified side to their business, they are able to be members. And in those organizations, but I believe so in some as well that maybe aren't accredited, within their organizations, they do have processes in place where they maintain and assess the clients that they're delivering services to. So I think to clarify, Tony, if there are agencies that employ, I guess you would have to look at each individual agency, but they provide multi-service, a menu of multiple services. And I know that there is an administrator and probably a nurse on staff or social worker that's putting together that menu of services. So there is somebody watching in the larger agencies, there is somebody watching for that coordination of care component, or when they sit down and talk to a family and assess what they may be able to provide for the family in accordance with the family's needs, they do that coordination of care. But not all companies providing these services are structured that way. Does that help? Yeah.
We've heard a lot about discharge planning from the hospital, and they are discharged. Do they contact? Is there an interface between the discharge planners and these services? Because what we heard was that people are discharged with a day to find some place to put them, and their discharge planners have no idea of what's available, and a lot of mishaps happen.
I'm checking the clock, because discharge planning is a topic unto itself. But let me give you a quick kind of update. I know there's a lot of rumor out there about discharge planning, and it doesn't mean that rumor isn't something to pay attention to as well. But so discharge planning, let me share with you a little bit about what the Healthcare Association of Hawaii is doing in this area. We have a group of chief nurses, so they're their nurse executives of the hospitals who meet monthly. Within that forum, we've brought together a group of stakeholders that include the Quest Expanded Health Plans, Department of Human Services, the Going Home Plus grant program representative, and the Executive Office on Aging. And what our discussions have focused on is process mapping discharging. We process map within the hospital. What does an admission to discharge look like? Who touches it? How many people are involved? What are the requirements in the course of that stay? Similarly, the plans have process mapped what does a discharge look like when they pick it up and take it out into wherever the post-acute care setting is, so after the hospital. Why are we going through that drill? Well, part of what we're trying to do is get to what Laura is wanting to clarify. Where do we intersect? So where can we get some optimal outcomes, knowing that maybe there might be five people in a circle in one part of that process and, oops, nobody in a circle at another part of that process. So looking at gaps and looking at opportunities so that the end result is that in all of us working together, we make sure that we have a successful experience for the consumer and, more importantly, that we have a discharge that allows them to have a good outcome once they go wherever they go after the hospital. As far as the referral options, which may include home care agencies, the consumers are supposed to be given choice, and they are supposed to be given information that helps them to understand where to look for services. And exactly how that's done, as far as are they given three names, or when the health plan gets involved, they do have service coordinators that can assist, or case managers in that process. But again, I think part of what needs to happen is we've got to provide some good educational tools for the consumers so that they know after they go through a hospital stay exactly what it is that they should expect. But the discharge planning process should include choice. We're not done yet with our studying. So we've had about, I think, three meetings where we've gotten the process mapping laid out, and we're doing some action and tasking, dependent upon what the issue is. But stay tuned. So yes, we were heavily involved in this, and you may have picked up that even in federal health reform, one of the things that they're looking at is readmissions, that they're having to check to see. So if you think of everything in a circle, you can't just look at the back door, you have to look at the front door too. And we have a grant application that we put together at the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, where we're seeking to get funding for an electronic discharge system that would connect the acute to the post-acute environment. Part of the funding request also includes a database for HHIC, the Hawaii Health Information Corporation, where they can begin to collect discharge data. Out of that discharge data, what we hope to be able to do is to learn more about what are the challenged populations that we're seeing, not necessarily wait lists, but what are the challenges we're seeing in the populations being discharged for which we don't have necessarily systems or solutions in place. So that data would help us to focus on these populations that maybe are having recurrent admissions and begin to cut down on some of that as well. But you're exactly right, Laura. There's a lot there's a lot more that we need to learn about with respect to the discharge planning process and ways that we can strengthen that in our healthcare delivery system.
Let me ask a question. Would somebody actually be discharged knowing that not everything is in place in the home to care for them? Well, I know they are. In other words, are people being discharged, let's say, to the home? On Maui, they say to the beach, where there's nobody to care for them, which is almost a guarantee they're going to end up back in your hospital. Is that happening?
Larry, we've all read the newspapers and seen the kinds of things that are being publicly reported. So let me just say this. I think the heart of that question really gets to some of the social issues as well that we're dealing with in the state. We have a homeless population that's been growing, and some of the challenges with the homeless population has to do with guardianship. Who's responsible for these individuals? Some patients, it's difficult just being able to get the guardianship process completed, and during this last legislative session, with the support of legislators, we had a resolution that was seeking to engage the AG's office around just focusing on this guardianship process for medical issues. So the Office of Public Guardian is very intent on ensuring that the consumer's rights are protected. They don't want to shorten the guardianship process, and we certainly respect that. What we look forward to having is a conversation that says, we don't want to take away anyone's explicit rights or benefits either, but there's a problem staring us in the face, and that is that the medical services continue in the course of needing, in other words, the imperative to continue to deliver medical services continues irrespective of the duration of the guardianship process. That if that process doesn't keep pace with what's happening over here in the medical system, certain things don't get done. Certain opportunities for the consumer to receive services in another setting can't progress until a guardian is determined to contribute to the decision-making in that process. Do you understand what I mean? So that's one example where the work with the public and the private sector needs to be synchronized so that it's more, it recognizes the challenges that we face in delivering services to some of the populations that maybe don't have families. Same thing with, there have been debates in the literature about the homeless population. If you have someone who's homeless but is determined to be competent, is it for us to say that they are not allowed to be discharged back to the street? It's their choice.
Well, you've answered an important question, but mine was actually not on Maui. I guess it's related to the homeless issues that have come up. But we talked about case management, and also the theme for today is people who are going to be cared for in their home, and you mentioned that they have a choice. It's not just a choice; they have to have the services lined up and in place for the day after or the day they get discharged. So the question is, if there's no case manager involved and these services are not in place, and I'm not, referring to the homeless here, I'm referring to other than the homeless, people who have a home, are these people discharged? Or how, without case management, how can you even be sure that these services are in place for them and that it's okay to discharge them?
Well, every population doesn't necessarily require a case manager. The families, many times, the majority of the time, serve as the individuals that work to be that advocate for the consumer in going home, right? So you could have a surgical discharge. Someone that goes in, has their appendix removed, it's a normal length of stay, they go home, and the family takes on those responsibilities. There are situations where case managers are required. That's the model that Department of Human Services has set up for the home and community-based settings. And let me just say that I think that it's not, the process may be enabled and may not be enabled just by the fact that something is mandated. What needs to be in place is a process that demonstrates that it's going to work. Just because you assign somebody doesn't mean that those actionable steps are occurring. And I think that's what we're trying to get to the heart of in this discharge planning process, is we have things on paper that say how it's supposed to work, but we have areas of opportunity to make sure that we're making improvements in those areas. So case managers, the concept behind case management is that the professional is supposed to take a complex case and help and ensure that they have assisted in setting up the necessary needs in the home prior to the person being discharged, but also continuing to stay involved in the case, not just monitoring it, but doing actionable steps. And so I understand what your question is, Larry, that the case manager is supposed to be there to provide those services. There are case managers in hospitals, there are case managers in the health plans, there are case managers that work independently. So I think that there are plenty of opportunities for those services to be available. What we really need to look at as a state is it working?
I think we've reached the time we have to close for today, so I want to thank you very much for coming. These are difficult questions, and you have a difficult task ahead of you, and I think we all appreciate it. We appreciate you coming here to speak to us today. Thanks very much.